Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 48, titled Saints and Miracles.
So that, you know, the idea that even a criminal can transform, this of course is the Buddhist view of human nature, that human beings are the reason it's such a valuable life form is that it's radically deprogrammable, reprogrammable, and that's why then education is everything. Because human being, you get these things from certain anthropologists, you know, about humans, that they're all hardwired about this and that. You hear about how hardwired we all are from various types of so-called scientists. But actually, the thing about humans is that a saint can become not a complete enlightened person by Buddhist definition. They can no longer become a criminal. But other than sort of a super consciousness changed being, can become evil having been good, or very, very good having been evil. That's the thing. So then Milarepa's sort of reputation in Tibet, why his story is such a big deal with the Tibetans, is he's the first ordinary Tibetan, mainly a sinner and a criminal, who then becomes perfectly enlightened, not just a little enlightened, a little bit of a lama, but perfectly enlightened. And actually, as you see later, if you got through the whole thing, how many of you have managed to read the whole thing? It is a quick read. I see. Well, it's meant to. It's put on this day because people often leave, actually, and don't even come to this class. They go off for Thanksgiving. They go have a long distance to go. And it's sort of a nice thing to read that's yet part of the course. So I always put it on this day before Thanksgiving in the fall. And in the sense of he was a definite ordinary person, sinner, at the beginning. And he became a perfect Buddha by the end, supposedly, you know, Milarepa. And he was really, and what is also great about it, one of the things that I particularly like about it, is those stories I read you, I think, last time that I was here, about the siddhas, a little bit. I read you one or two of those stories. And actually, I thought even that I had masters of Mahamudra here, but I didn't. But anyway, I usually assign more of them. People say read lots of them because they're fun, those Siddha stories, the stories of the adepts in India. But in India, because of the lack of interest in history, it seems, whatever the Indian cultural world was at ancient time, you don't have any life story really, sort of all what they did forever, you know. Whereas here you have a whole, someone who's definitely in the tradition of the adepts, right, is one generation away. Marpa studies with Naropa, who is one of the most important of the 84 Mahasiddhas, whose teacher is Dilopa, who is also very important, of the 84 Mahasiddhas, great adept. And then Marpa teaches Milarepa. And then Milarepa becomes, and even if you remember Naropa, there's that story where Naropa bows to Tibet. And Marpa sees that, and Marpa goes to see him, and then the trees even bow toward Tibet. And then Marcus says, oh, really, great, your student, my grand student, will be the great person. And Marcus, what about me? You know? Marcus makes a big mistake in that when he goes to see Naropa, Naropa makes a Hevajra Buddha, a tantric Buddha called Hevajra, who looks sort of like Shiva Nataraj, you know, is like very dynamic, practically breathing flames, you know, like, oh my God, hey Vajra. And he says to Marpa, he says, okay, here I am, there's the Yidam, there's the archetype deity, hey Vajra, the laughing Vajra, and who do you bow to first? And Marpa says, well, I see you all the time, you know, I'm going to bow to that deity. And then, bing, you know, you missed your choice in the quiz show, you know, oh, that's a bad omen. You know, because actually the guru is all the Buddhas incarnate type thing, and that's just one manifestation of the guru. So Marpa has a lot of flaws, apparently, more than Milarepa. Although his own biography is quite amazing, too, Marpa's. But I don't like Marpa. He beats his wife. He's like, he makes Milarepa do more crimes, you know. He's like, He's a great teacher of Maharepa, and he's quite good. Then he disobeys the Dakinis, and he transmits the teaching of what's called Dromjuk, or body snatching, the body snatching teaching, which apparently is where you can occupy the body, which they used to use in India. And actually, there was one Russian yogi, Vedantic Hindu yogi, who came here two years ago, and claimed that his guru had lived 1,000 years by getting different bodies when he would get old. In India, that was all right, apparently, because people, some healthy, seemingly strong person dies for some reason, and then they just put the body, among poor people, put the body without burning it, without burying it, they put it in the charnel ground. So then the old yogi goes and inhabits that body, shifts their consciousness to another body. They believe that's possible, if someone has attained such and such. And then they have a new, then they revive that body, and they're not just zombies, they become like really alive, they make it really alive. They can go into bodies of an animal and everything. They say, it's called Dromjuk, or Parakaya Pravesha in Sanskrit. And whatever its status is, we're not going to get into that. But of the six yogas of Naropa, the Dakinis told Marpa not to transmit that to anybody, that they didn't want that in Tibet, because there were not bodies lying around in Tibet, because in Tibet, they're scared of zombies, and so any strong, healthy person, they like tie them up after they die, just in case a zombie inhabits them or something. And also then they dismember the bodies or burn them in some cases. So they get rid of them that way. They don't have bodies lying around, in other words, in Tibet. And so they didn't want that to be transmitted. So he transmits it to his son anyway, Marpa does. And then the son has a conflict with someone called Ralozawa, who is a contemporary. And they have a kind of magic battle, and the son loses. And then he transmits his mind into a pigeon, takes over the body of a pigeon, flies to India. There's a whole long story about it. You know, the legend type stories are kind of fun. They're very sci-fi. Buddhism as a whole is quite sci-fi, I think, by now you realize. Even Theravada or Pali Buddhism is also sci-fi. Okay, but Milarepa is still a marvelous story. It was the first book on Tibetan Buddhism that I ever read. Almost, not the first book on Buddhism, but on Tibetan Buddhism. And it was recommended to me by Henry Miller, actually. The notorious, famous writer, Henry Miller, who said this is the St. Francis of Asia, you know, like Francis of Assisi, you know. And it's not a particularly Tibetan thing. I don't know if you know that, but Francis of Assisi and his biographies, written, I think, by St. Boniface, is the one who writes the main biographies of Francis of Assisi. When Francis gives certain events, major events in his life, all the people in a whole province in Italy, wherever he lives, they see angels in the sky, they have mass visions, you know, totally. And so you have that in the Western history too, you know. And of course, modern materialist people say, oh, that's all just whatever. Although there is one thing, this will amuse you. There's a place in China, a famous place. I just have to tell you this before Thanksgiving. Famous place called Wutaishan in Chinese, Ryuzhenga in Tibetan, which is a holy place of Tibetans, Mongolians, etc., because there are these five mountains that are kind of weird mountains because all five of them have flat tops. And they're pretty big mountains. I've been up to the middle one, up to the top, and it really is flat, and they're very springy. There's water coming out of them. So they're like marshy, which makes them, then in Chinese and Tibetan Buddhist sort of mythology, or whatever you want to call it, believe, this is the holy land of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, of perfect wisdom. And the five is like a, you know, mandalic form in itself. And I had a friend, a colleague, I don't know where he is now, he was at Santa Cruz for years, might have retired by now, Raoul Birnbaum is his name, who was a little bit art historian, a little bit Buddhologist, and he did a big study of the tradition of the Wutaishan that there are mass visions. And by mass vision, I mean it's like everybody in the middle of the quad would look up and they would see FDR and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and they'd be there for 2 or 3 days. And like people would come in off the street, you know, the guy come up on the subway, oh, there they are. And they'd just be up there, and everybody would see them, not just your mystically gifted. There, and then these are in Francis's biographies and in a lot of some Western quote unquote hagiographies, you know, because that means we don't believe in that nowadays. So Raoul Birnbaum went to study this, and then he gave a talk. at the Association of Asian Studies, you know, academic sort of thing, where you could, he had a paper there. And at the high moment of his paper, where he said that these visionary events were happening at increasing frequency at Wutaishan and was causing anxiety amongst the authorities, the communist authorities, who, you know, didn't like people having religious hysteria, mass hysteria, and seeing visions in the sky that everybody, the bus drivers and stuff, were seeing. So not like only the mystically gifted. And then his high point, he brandished this sign, which I'm trying to remember if I think it was a red sign with white Chinese character letters, or it could have been white with red letters. I think red with white letters. And it had chains on the two ends of the sign, and it was metal, and it was about that long. And he pulled it out of the talk, and he brandished it. And those who knew Chinese, so I knew a little more now then than I remember now. But anyway, that's all. So, but the people, the sinologists in the audience were approving his translation. And what it said on that sign, which was a road-blocking sign on a road going to Wutaishan, and it said, mass delusive visions are illegal in the People's Republic of China. Stop. And he was so thrilled about it that even the communist authorities were acknowledging that this was a phenomenon, and they were, of course, banning it. But they couldn't ban it out of the sky or shoot it down with airplanes. But this, you know, Kuan Yin or whatever it was, you know, he was saying that he was giving records of what were in the newspapers of different visions that were seen on that month or for the two weekends or at the full moon of that time, in the daytime, day and night and so on. So this doesn't seem to be a phenomenon that human beings are capable of having such visions. I don't know why. Anyway, why did I get into that? I forgot. Well, yeah, because Milarepa's levitating. And then in the Tibetan story, remember when Milarepa goes by at one point, he levitates by, he's flying from one place to another, and the uncle's nephew, one of the survivors of the uncle's clan, sees him and runs to the uncle and says, "Oh, look, uncle, there's Milarepa." And he was levitating for a second. The uncle says, "Oh, yeah, where's my bow and arrow? I'm going to shoot him down." Because, you know, he still hates him. And then his wife says, "Don't do that. He's like a magician. He'll, like, destroy us," or something like that. And that was after Milarepa was trying to be good, you know. He was trying to behave himself, you know. There's an incident in here like that. I don't know if you remember it, if you happen to read the whole thing. But, so there's a lot of stuff like that. Now in Robert Paul's thing, I try to get a little drawing of this. This is kind of fun. It sort of does account for why the Milarepa story became such an archetypal story for the Tibetan in Robert Paul's analysis, which I never thought of before reading his thing, although I'd read it, as I say, long back. And that is, it's the kind of the idea of lineages, you know, of lineages. And you have two lineages in the story, and one is Mila's lineage, and one is Marpa's lineage. Okay, and then Mila's lineage is kind of, and I forgot how to call that. Anyway, Mila's lineage gets broken, it's blocked, and has no fruition. Peta doesn't have any children. He kills off the uncle, which in a whole branch of his family, because they behaved badly and so on. Marpa also, his blood lineage has no continuation. It's a sort of thing like that. Because his son, Dharma Dode, he gets killed by Marpa mistakenly giving him this teaching he wasn't supposed to, and then the kid gets very arrogant and he runs into a different yogi and then he dies. And so, in other words, the blood lineage is broken of the two main lineages of the story. Equals no fruition. But then there's, you could call it the Dharma lineage. That is to say, spiritual son, thrives. It's like a central subliminal message of this book. Because then, see, Marpa transmits to Mila as an individual, and Marpa becomes Mila's father. You know, Marpa is the spiritual father, And you know, you rehearsal all those songs he teaches, where every time he holds up his hand like that to listen to the Dakinis, then he salutes his father. So then there's this new idea of lineage, which is the Dharma lineage. You know, and then the whole Kagyu order, new order, you know, and then there's Gampopa and Rechungpa and Sila Repa. And so all kinds of children they have, and they flourish, and they become huge. Karmapa is one of them, the famous Karmapa Lama. And there are many other, there are like 12 branches of the Kagyu order that develop from this time. And so Mila and Marpa, you know, they have their set of four, which is Tilopa, Naropa, Marpa, and Lila. And then onward, there's many, many branches. And that's a very flourishing lineage. And what does lineage mean? You know, lineage is like genetic lineage we think of. So that one of the central things of the book, in a way, patterns of the book, is the unfruitfulness of blood lineage and the fruitfulness of Dharma lineage, you could say. That's like a main theme. And I never even noticed it until one Freudian guy, you know, psychotherapist, who lived in Nepal because his wife of that time used to teach here too. Sherry Ortner was an anthropologist studying Tibetan and Himalayan, Tibetan and Nepali Buddhist societies. So he kind of then got into it, and then he took his he read the literature in translation, and then he got into seeing it in a psychoanalytic way. And it's very, and I have to admit, it was very, very fascinating. And I think very valid, transmitting this thing. Now, for example, in those tantras, you know, that you were introduced to in the context of our end of the story of Indian Buddhism, in the tantra, when you do what they call a sadhana, or a performance script, or an achievement of, you know, like a practice script, which is a series of visualizations and rituals that are part of tantric creation stage meditation, which Tom Yarno was telling you about in great detail, no doubt. He wrote an excellent book about it, did a translation and wrote an excellent book about it. And the whole thing there is that the beginning of the sadhana has to do with lineage. And there's a lineage of who has been practicing this from Buddha even until your immediate teacher. And there's a ritual where you, at the beginning, invoke that lineage, and then you, coming down to the teacher from whom you received the initiation, and then you kind of think of them as your family. And they're like your ancestors. And then there's an interesting thing that I didn't notice until probably 25 years of, or 30 years of studying about Tibetan history and culture and the teachings and so on. And then also traveling more in other Asian cultures. And of course in India, a big thing, you know, if you're a Brahmin, especially if you're an upper caste or warrior caste, Kshatriya, or one of the various, many various Vaishya classes, you know, merchant classes, or artisanal classes, they're very much highly differentiated since the Muslim occupation of India a long time ago. But if you're a member of them, they do have ancestor rights that are a big thing. That, you know, especially in patriarchal things, they're the rights of the fathers particularly. You know, they don't pay so much attention to the mothers and the grandmothers, unfortunately, but very much the fathers, the male descendants. And China, of course, it's a huge thing, where one of the big things is, yearly or within certain seasonal cycles, in a certain calendar, they have rituals offering tea and cookies to the ancestors. And Japan is huge too, and Korea and so on. So, in a way, what people haven't noticed, anthropologists don't notice, is that Tibetans pay very little attention to their ancestors, even ordinary ones, not lamas or anything. They're not particularly interested in it, and they don't even know much. A few sort of very highfalutin Tibetans will say, "Well, I'm a descendant of so and so who was a minister of King Sonthing Gampo." There's even some who think they're somehow descended from the ancient Dharma kings, you know, back 1,000, 1,200 years ago. And there are very few like that. But mostly there's no notion of ancestor. They don't pay any attention to it. If you look at modern Buddhist teachers, for example, Thich Nhat Hanh from Vietnamese Buddhism makes a big fuss about his ancestors. And, you know, we have to be grateful about our ancestors. But Tibetans don't. And then if you think about why, well, it isn't that they didn't have that before. That's every tribe has a feeling of their, you know, oral tradition, you know, they're telling stories that were told to them by the grand old grandfather, and their grandfather is a big role. So what does it mean that you don't care about them? It means that's another thing of what I like to say, that Tibet is a place where the Buddha Dharma thing became sort of mainstream rather than a countercultural thing, sort of changing a little bit the sort of more nationalistic or tribalistic habits of particular nations, like Thailand or Cambodia or somewhere, where they still have those ancestral cults in parallel with the Buddhist Dharma thing. Because the idea is that when you become a mendicant, male or female, that you leave your worldly household, which means your family and your tribal lineage and your sense of race, actually. And you go into this new family descended from Buddha, which is where the transmission is spiritual. And in the case of Tantra, of course, you have the concept of a spiritual gene, even in regular Mahayana, and that you have a Bodhisattva gene, or you have an Arhat gene, or you have some other kind. They even use the same word. And as the English word gene, by the way, comes from Latin gens, which means a tribe. You know. So it's not that you didn't have parents and they are not, you know, you have a certain level, there's teachings about being respectful and kind, taken care of. And some Tibetans early on, when they were getting to know Western culture, especially America, they were horrified by the American cultural practice of putting the parent out into a home, you know, when they're old and not taking care of them, you know, and like putting them in those like assisted living places, that thing, and instead of keeping them in the family, you know. That's like that's terrible. And there are stories about that. They did that in Tibet when they were subsistence livelihood before the Buddhism. And I think I told you the story about the doctors who met a young girl, a granddaughter, who was putting her mother out in a cave and had to because that was the village culture before Buddhism. And the doctor, you know, remedied that. So the achievement why does karma theory do that to you? Because karma theory says that your ancestor is not hanging around somewhere waiting for a cookie and could care less what their descendants do, actually. Or maybe they care if they're in heaven and looking down, which sometimes they are, according to them, according to Buddhists as well as others. But really, they're reborn somewhere and they're dealing with life in their new way. And they're not necessarily, if they're reborn as human, they're not at all necessarily in the same tribe. You know, like a Japanese doesn't get reborn as a Japanese. Of course, people don't even get reborn as a human unless they're pretty cool, actually. But once as a human, then a male will be a female will be a male. And this, of course, undid this deeper biological feeling, or cosmological, biological, whatever you want to call it, a little bit undid the idea that our tribe deserves to conquer the neighboring tribe, because the neighboring tribe might be full of my ancestors, if you follow me. So actually, Asia therefore became a little bit less militarized than the West because of this. Although they remilitarized periodically, because at each generation they became a little more pacified, then some nomads would come in there and beat them up, like the Tibetans or the Mongolians, and take over China and India. You know, Mughals in India, Mongolians in Tibet, and so on. So the idea that that the Buddhist thing a little bit ruins the notion of tribal solidarity, racism, the feeling that our tribe is superior to every other one, and therefore we should dominate them, and so on, you know, which is the essence of projection of the human self-centered egotism into like a familial and then tribal thing. And it's eroded by that biological theory, karmic theory, of that people are reborn not at all necessarily in the same clan or tribe, although there are many instances of people claiming that Uncle Joe is now the daughter of my nephew and something like that, or the, whatever. There's a lot of that in their own sort of notion. But it is a powerful thing. And then in that light, this story, which becomes a major archetypal story for Buddhists, is a very key thing about it. So that, you know, I was giving a lecture in some other setting not long ago, coming up on Thanksgiving. And so the concept of thanksgiving is done in those tantric sadhanas to the ancestor. But the ancestor is not the racial ancestor. It's not your blood family. It's your spiritual family. It's your guru and then all their gurus, which are all different nations they could be. And this accounts, I think, for Tibetans sort of something special about the Tibetan personality and the Tibetan culture, that they somehow, by having mainstreamed this view and it become like sort of common sense to them, in other words, it became their consensual reality that you don't look up in some sort of tribal happy hunting ground for your ancestor, and then anybody who's not in your bloodline is somehow lesser than you. I mean, they have a bit of that too. You know, they have their own, like a nationalistic thing a little bit, but not to the degree that other people who are, you know, exceptionalism about their country and their culture and their race and their and even their gender, you know, which we've noted, which we can note in the world as a major problem actually at the moment, isn't it? And then which is in history has been transmitted into spirituality, and therefore you get the idea of religious, you know, crusaders, Christian solidarities, Islamic solidarities, Jewish solidarities, and so forth. So it can be diffused from a racial thing to a religious thing when you get that religious culture being all dominated. But then that's all defeated by the idea that, what is this? You know, my rabbinic great-grandfather was reborn as a Muslim. Or my Allah-worshipping Muslim great-grandfather is reborn as Jewish or Christian or secularist or whatever it could be. It sort of diffuses the whole game about how my tribe versus the universe, which is simply a blow-up of the individual samsaric feeling of me versus the universe that we started out the year with, remember? As the essence of the second noble truth, you know, the source of suffering. And So the Milarepa story, in other words, contains that, which I learned not from any Tibetan, but I learned it from, and so I guess I subliminally learned it from reading Milarepa's biography, but I learned it from a Western psychiatrist who analyzed the story that way. I have to express, Robert Paul is his name, I have to express my gratitude to him.